Hello, and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're on the web at kuci.org and on iTunes at College Radio. Today is Wednesday, April 25th, 2018. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and my guest today for the entire hour is Luis Alberto Uria. Luis is the critically acclaimed and best-selling author of 17 books, including poetry, fiction, essays, for which he's won awards. Uria has also won an Edgar from the Mystery Writers of America for Best Short Story. It was in Phoenix Noir, 2009, Amapola, and featured in the Water Museum. He was born in Tijuana to a Mexican father and American mother. He is most recognized as a border writer, though he says, "I am more interested in bridges, not borders." His newest novel is The House of Broken Angels, published by Little Brown, and that'll be the focus of our talk today. Hello, Luis.
Good morning.
So glad to have you again.
Yeah, this is great.
We just saw each other on Sunday at the LA Times Festival of Books.
For those, yes, we did.
Those of you out there who might wonder what we're talking about, every year in April, usually the middle of April, the Los Angeles Times Festival of Books takes place. I'm usually up there moderating a panel, and this year I had the honor of moderating a panel with Luis and Lisa C. and Margaret Sexton Wilkerson. And it was just, I thought it was just a great panel. The three of you, the theme was family, and the three of you, I thought, were so perfectly matched that it was sort of amazing to me that it was like that. So we're going to cover some of the same ground that we covered on Sunday, but with more to talk about, because there wasn't nearly enough time to talk about everything I wanted to talk about regarding The House of Broken Angels. So let's begin with hearing you talk about the genesis of the novel.
Oh, gosh. Well, I think I was saying this in L.A., but I was well into a different novel. 400 pages in, closing in on the end, and my big brother Juan had been suffering with cancer for quite a while, and he was in the end game. You know, he was tired and had been quite ill. He'd had three remissions, and his granddaughter suggested that his 74th birthday was coming. Wouldn't it be nice to give him a birthday party? Everybody understanding that it was really a farewell, his last party on earth. And we all went and observed, I think I called it on the panel, the Mexican Finnegan's Wake. You know, because it was remarkable, you know, of course, heartbreaking and tender, but at the same time, wildly inappropriate and hilarious. And, you know, they had invited every kind, every level, every layer of Mexican family, Chicano family, and everybody showed up. And, you know, it was in my brother's backyard, a little barrio house there and Southeast San Diego, and you know, to watch this gathering of the tribes, and all to honor this man, you know, who had tried to be a good dad and a good neighbor and a good uncle and grandpa and all these things, and to see him sort of orchestrate his living wake, you know, sitting in the middle of this swirl of people receiving praise and loving it, was an amazing thing. And you know, he was weak and had to go to bed during the day. And once he went to bed, he would spend an hour or so in bed and then come back out. And when he went back to bed, he called for me, wanted me to come get in bed with him as his kid brother, which to me was, you know, this amazing experience, because he had never been a cuddly man in any way, not huggy or any of that sort of thing. He believed that you showed your love. You didn't have to talk about it. Mm. You would, you know. And so he wanted me in bed with him, and so we spent time in bed together, and then everybody else heard we were in bed together, so they started coming and crawling in bed with us. It was the most amazing thing. And I think that being in bed with my brother and or whatever relatives were coming down the hall, that kind of inspired writing this book.
Wow. Talk a little bit about the time frame, too. We talked about that Sunday, but so much is packed into these 2 days that the novel takes place.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I think, you know, if you're paying attention, a day can be an epic journey, you know, and 2 days can be even more epic. And in real life, he was my half-brother. As I pointed out, in L.A., my dad was a playa, and he had a couple of, you know, relationships out there, but there was a previous family, and he was the eldest of that family. And his mom was turning 100, and he was turning 74 in the same year. And she had been ill for a while. And it turned out that the week before his party, she died. And since he was still, in spite of his diminished state physically, the patriarch, self-acknowledged and announced patriarch, who had taken over the reins of all family things after my father died, he was responsible for her funeral. And because, you know, the family, people aren't rich, you know, people don't have time to keep taking off work for 2 weekends or weeks or to travel to San Diego repeatedly, he made her funeral the day before his party, which was remarkable in so many ways because, you know, the craziness of the actual party began at the funeral. It was sort of a family reunion, celebration, goodbye, grandma, then followed by a birthday party, which had the pall of death, but mad partying over it. So it was this emotionally extremely dense 2 days, and I think it was, you know how Kafka said that, you know, writing was that axe that broke the frozen sea within us? I think this double barrel mortality and life celebration happening at once was the axe that broke open all the Mexicanness and familyness and community all at once. Just everything came pouring out. It was like a piñata, the piñata of fate burst open and gave this crazy thing to witness and take part in.
When the character of Little Angel came on, I must have immediately thought of you because he's a professor, he's a writer, and so, you know, and of course I read this before we talked, and I was wondering how autobiographical then the book is. I mean, how how fictionalized is the story? How autobiographical is it? All that.
Well, you know, I wanted it to be true. You know, the best fiction is true, truer than true. And so I needed it based in things. It was certainly a celebration of my brother, no question, and a celebration of family. I don't know if it's my family, but it's certainly family, and it's certainly in light of the build the wall kind of thing of the Mexican family in general. But I also wanted it to have, you know, a firm basis in a lived reality. So, yeah, Big Angel is very much inspired by my brother Juan, though the details of the life aren't in any way true. And so when you have a title like Broken Angels, you have to have another angel. You can't just have one. So, yeah, his kid brother definitely was inspired by my experience because I thought this is kind of representative of this transition transitional phase of family, you know, going from a Mexican immigrant family to actually being an American family. So there's a whole theme of assimilation, transformation, bilingualism, and all that. But what better experience than the kid brother being the offspring of a Mexican dad and an American mom? That being the case, he has a certain isolation, and that was me. Mm-hmm. So it gave me that personal perspective. And the other person who's absolutely biographical in it is Big Angel's wife, Perla. You know, so the entire book and story exists because of the relationship. Oop, there goes my dog. This dog could even be in it, too. But, you know, goes the relationship between those two was this astonishing love story for a family that hadn't experienced, I don't think, a lot of astonishing love stories, mm-hmm. you know, especially with our dad and his history and so forth. And my brother was impassioned, absolutely dedicated to his wife. And they'd been together, I don't know, over 50 years. Mm. And she was still, you know, like his spring bride, even as both of them got older and older. So I thought that was really kind of beautiful. Mm-hmm. So I stuck close to that. And a couple of the characters in the book are based on real nieces and nephews, and others are made up of whole cloth or have come from other experiences. You know, there are little bits of my wife's family, little bits of my cousins deep in Mexico, little bits of my Urrea family, great swaths of weird memories of mine, or just feverish imaginings. And I tried to put them all together because I wanted to create the family epic for the Mexican family.
Mm-hmm. So then when you're basing a novel on something that happened or someone in particular,
yeah.
How do you then let yourself go and fictionalize? I mean, are they in the back of your mind? Are they going to worry about this? Are they going to love this? I mean, how do you let all that go?
Of course.
Yeah?
Of course you worry about that. But, you know, I've said elsewhere, and it bears repeating, I come from a long line of unreliable narrators. My family has a whole lot of generously put tall tale spinners. And that certainly was a feature, and I was quite worried about it. Honestly, I thought, I hope the family isn't offended or upset, you know, or I haven't told too many tales, you know, that they don't want told. But on the other hand, you know, it's nice for the family to feel like they've gotten such recognition. And I had no idea the book was going to blow up in the way it has. And, you know, I think our family really appreciates having fans. You know, it's become a kind of a theme now, you know. And I think I mentioned this on our panel, that being a Mexican family, my brother died right after the party. You know, our family has a certain gut feeling that he co-wrote the book from heaven, and he's orchestrating the book tour, and he's had a hand in the book reviews. So that removed some pressure. And then, you know, over the pre-publication stuff, I was trying to keep it quiet. I didn't want to tell anybody. And, of course, that's folly, because they're going to find out sooner or later. And, you know, we would go to San Diego, my wife and I, on different trips, and always go visit Juan's widow. Blanca is her name. And, you know, we were there one day, and all of us gathered in their little kitchen, and Blanca sat down, and she said, "So, you have something to tell me." And I thought, oh, gosh. And I said, "What?" innocently. And she said, "You know what?" And I said, "You mean my book?" "Yes." I said, oh, well, gosh. And then I just, you know, I said I wanted to honor your marriage, and I wanted to honor my brother, and I wanted to honor Mexican families, and I wrote this book, and I said it's a novel. So it began a sort of an impromptu writing workshop with my relatives where I would sit down with various relatives and they say, you know, now when you write a novel, it's fake. You make it up. It's not. But, you see, Uncle Luis is making a movie in his head, you see. And that movie, to play well as I write it, has to sometimes star you, because I don't know how this scene would play out. So you are acting in the movie in my head, and I put you in it. And they were like, oh, that's very interesting. Yeah.
Oh, this would be a wonderful time to hear you read from The House of Broken Angels.
Okay. Let me grab it here. I just thought I would read some of the opening.
Sure.
Might as well start at the start, right?
That's right.
Okay. So the first chapter is called Big Angels Last Saturday, and I'll just read a little bit of it for you.
Okay.
Big Angel was late to his own mother's funeral. He tossed in his bed, the sheets catching his feet in a tangle. Sweat tickled his sides as he realized what was happening. The sun was up. It was bright through his eyelids, the burning pink world. Everybody else would be there before him. No, not this. Not today. He struggled to rise. Mexicans don't make these kinds of mistakes, he told himself. Every morning since his diagnosis, he had the same thoughts. They were his alarm clock. How could a man out of time repair all that was broken? And on this morning, as he was awakening to these worries, cursed by the light, cursed in every way by time, betrayed by his exhausted body while his mind raged, he was startled to find his father's ghost sitting beside him on the bed. The old man was smoking one of his Pall Malls. That's a lot of weight to carry around, his father said. Time to wake up and let it go. He was speaking English. His accent had gotten smoother. The old man became smoke and rose in curls to vanish against the ceiling. Big Angel blinked his eyes. He was the family's human clock. If he was still asleep, they were all still asleep. They could sleep till noon. His son would sleep till three. Big Angel was too weak to leap up and start shouting. He poked his wife in the back until she started, looked over her shoulder at him, and sat up. We're late, flaca, he said. No, she cried. Ay, Dios. See? He said, deeply satisfied somehow to be the one to lay down a rebuke. She sprang from the bed and raised the alarm. Their daughter, Minnie, was asleep on the living room couch, visiting for the night so she'd be on time. His wife shouted, and his daughter crashed into the coffee table. Ma, she complained. Ma! He put his fists to his eyes. The women came into the room without a word and levitated him out of bed. They helped him to the bathroom to brush his teeth. His wife took a comb to his bristly stand-up hair. He had to sit to pee. They looked away. They wrestled him into slacks and a white shirt and planted him on the edge of the bed. I'm going to miss Mama's funeral, he told the universe. I never cry, he announced, his eyes bright with hard light. They ignored him. Daddy's always watching everything, his daughter said. Es tremendo, her mother replied.
Thank you so much. That was Luis Alberto Uria reading from The House of Broken Angels, published by Little Brown. You know, I got this when I was reading it, but hearing you read it, it comes through even more, and that is the poetry and the writing and the rhythm of the words and the sentences. And so I was wondering as I was reading it, now listening to you, I'm wondering again, how do you do that? I mean, is that first draft stuff? Does it just come out because you have this poetry background? Or as you're going through revision, are you then really working on the rhythm of the words, of the sentences, of the imagery. Can we talk about that?
Yeah, I think it just seems to be the way that I narrate. Maybe it is the poetry background. I mean, if I could have figured out how to play that first cheap guitar they got me when I was a kid, I might not have written books. You know, I'd probably be happy playing in one of those grandpa blues bands at the bowling alleys. You know, but I started two finger typing instead. But also, you know, all of the stuff, not all of it, especially in this book, most of the stuff in this book happened originally in Spanish, right? All the stuff that I'm thinking about. And so it's in Spanish, and I'm sort of pre-translating it into an English milieu, which will then be a really weird experience working on the Spanish translation back into Spanish. But so I think part of it is certainly in the Latino-themed stories and books is a kind of a sense of trying to write in English that echoes the vibe of Spanish.
Hmm.
If that makes any sense. It's got a certain other flair to it,
right?
I've noticed now. I realize I think that's just the way I write. But I also think everyone I meet has a Mexican grandma. And it's mm-hmm. not true. You know, I only know the world as I've known it. And, you know, you're not all from Tijuana. Oh, I get it.
Right.
You know, you don't dream in Spanish. Oh, right.
Mm-hmm.
So in that way, I think that's part of it. And I would say the third element, since this is Writers on Writing, is that I am always interested when I read to be, I would like to be put into a waking dream. I read books almost to go to a trance, you know, to be taken elsewhere. And so I think I'm trying to write to the trance, and that I want the book to be a magic carpet to another world. And I think that you can do that with musical rhythms in what you write.
Yeah, your writing is so musical, and there's so much imagery. I have so many little post-it notes all over this book of just wonderful lines or metaphors or similes or whatever that all seem just so original.
Thank you.
It's a study for writers who are writing a novel or memoir and want to see how it's done. As well, you in the middle of the book, there's a wonderful flashback, a Big Angel flashback of when he met his wife. When I think in the book they're 16 or she's 16.
Yes.
And such great backstory that you go into and come out of so effortlessly. Will you talk about that section? I think it's like 125 to 164 is all. All backstory, and you know, usually you discourage writers from putting in too much backstory, right? Here's an example of it working so well.
Well, thank you. It's interesting because, you know, this is the value of a good editor. Actually, my editor Ben George, I think I said this in L.A., but we certainly engaged in hand-to-hand combat for a couple of years, fighting over everything in the book, just trying to get it perfect, you know? And it was sort of like a WWE wrestling match sometimes. and the original version of it was two sections, the two party days, with all of these memories wafting through like a bit of incense or something.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really taxing, we realized, for the readers. It's already a complicated book, but that made it even more complicated. And, you know, I think it might have been Ben or the two of us at the same moment realizing that we could take all those threads and construct a middle section between the 2 days, which would define what you just read and predefine what you're about to read.
Mm.
And so we took all the, not all, but a lot of those historic elements out, and then I reworked it into a standalone section, you know, more complete and polished. And I have to say that those passages of the motorcycle ride and the landscape and getting to know her on the beach and so forth, this, some of my favorite stuff in the book. I was really proud of it. And it's funny where things come from, you know, because that's all, of course, invented. My family's not from La Paz. I don't know if any of my family's even been to La Paz. Little things, you know, that you carry around in the back of your mind or that they just never leave you. For example, there's a scene where a whale breaches and you see the little flying fish going by looking like parakeets. Those are flying fish that I saw once in the Caribbean. I've never forgotten them. I thought, are those little parrots? And I thought, oh, my God, they're flying fish. And that little image of those little white-looking parakeet birds, parakeet fish going by, stuck around in my mind for 10 years, and all of a sudden, there they were. They could be in my novel. I was so happy.
Had you written it down, or you just remembered?
I've always remembered that weird sight of these little fish shooting out of the sea and flying along beside the boat we were on.
That's great.
And, you know, other stuff I'm sure is just a tapestry of small moments, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, I mean, everybody's, at least all of us from California have made out on a beach sometime, you know, so that was easy to kind of extrapolate their first fumbling moments on the beach.
Yeah, I love that section.
Thank you.
I just loved it.
Yeah, you know, some couple of high schools are using the book, and I think, oh my God, are you serious? But apparently the kids think it's interesting, though, when they realize that most of the erotic stuff is between, you know, 60-year-old people. I think it makes them a little queasy, but that's okay.
Well, we're going to take a very short break, allow you to take a sip of water, and we'll be back in just a couple of minutes with more Luis Alberto Urrea in the House of Broken Angels, so don't go anywhere.
Such a long, long time. Look like I get you off of my mind, but I can't. Just a thought of you turns my whole world misty blue. Just the mention of your name turns the flicker to a flame. Listen to me, good baby. I think of the things we used to do, and my whole world turns misty blue. Heaven knows I've tried. Baby, when I say that I'm glad we're through, deep in my heart I know I've lied. I've lied. I've lied. Such a long, long time. like I'd get you off of my mind, but I can't. Just the thought of you, my love, my whole world turns misty blue. Oh, 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 I can't, oh, I can't, oh, I can't forget you. My whole world turns misty blue. Oh, 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 my love, my whole world turns misty blue. Baby, 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 I can't forget you.
And that was Dorothy Moore, Misty Blue. Welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine, broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and on the web at kuci.org and on iTunes at College Radio. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and we've been here with Luis Alberto Urrea. His new novel is The House of Broken Angels. And if you're just tuning in or you want to hear the entire broadcast again, it will be podcast within the next week or so at penonfire.com. It'll be if you go to iTunes and subscribe to Writers on Writing, when it is podcast, it will land in your podcast file. And you can find out more about our scheduled guests on the show by going to penonfire.com, and the schedule's there on the homepage. Let's bring Luis back on. Hey there.
Hi.
So many great side characters, and curious about so many of them, but the first that comes to mind is Gloriosa. Where did she come from?
Gloriosa. Well, you know, I think so many of our families, Latino families, or Latinx, as we say now, but specifically Mexican families, you know, there's a matrix of women in our families who I think secretly run everything as well as the world. They let the men wander around crowing like roosters, but you know, they're in charge in a lot of ways. And in those matrices of family, of female family, there are women of various relation, but they're all, if they're older, they're all aunts. Mm-hmm. That's your tia Cuca. That's your tia Flaca. Everybody's your aunt. That's how you grow up. And we often have those really stylish, mysterious, powerful tias. Certainly had some in our family. And so Gloriosa was, in a way, a kind of ode to those women, the women who, you know, were the ones ill-fated to be the beautiful ones. And so it was her, within the novel, it was Gloriosa's fate to actually be you know, the beautiful sister of a family of suffering sisters. So they, in some ways, used her for bait. You know, they had a little restaurant, La Paz, and she was always so beautiful that they sort of kept her groomed as ever more gorgeous to help attract more clients, more men to come to buy food to eat. And she was inspired by a lot of the women folk in my family, in my extended family. Certainly. Hmm. And I have a friend who's a film actress from Mexico, and we were always joking on, you know, with each other that she'd say, you know, it's time for my Oscar. I'm ready for an Oscar. So I told her, I'm going to make a character for you in this novel, and then we'll get your Oscar. So I wrote it for her as kind of a gift. But it was also definitely an echo of of several real women I know, both in the family and, you know, not of the family.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can't remember if it was you or someone else on the panel on Sunday that said that that each secondary character should be fleshed out to deserve their own spinoff.
And oh, yeah, that was Lisa.
Was that Lisa?
I wholeheartedly concurred with that.
So talk about that, fleshing out side characters and how you decide who is going to get that fleshing out.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, you just can't fit everything in. It's impossible. And it was an act of mercy on the readers to keep some people a little bit sketchier than others because there's so many characters and so many events. And I actually had to trim people, shave away details, and even whole scenes, whole passages, because, you know, Ben, my editor, and I realized that I was asking a lot already. In my mind, I was making, you know, a literary Robert Altman film, you know, where everybody is happening at once, all the dialogue is cross-cutting. Mm-hmm. But I was trying really hard to make each subgroup or each character, even minor, vivid enough that you'd always know who it was. Kind of a episodic TV trick, right? Mm-hmm. But there are people who pass through in life, at the party. You know, there are certain people who are main players. Big Angel, his wife, his immediate kids, his kid brother. And then there are sort of a second layer of people, which are the siblings and their kids, Gloriosa and her sisters. And then there are various levels of extras and cameo parts. Right? So you want to give the sense of being in this overwhelming party, and there are a couple of mysterious characters that I don't fill out, but I think are really important. For example, Uki, and later on, Dave the Jesuit, you know, these characters who are central in an oddly oblique way to the story. Mm-hmm. But, you know, otherwise it would have been War and Peace because I couldn't, you know, I could write 100 pages about everybody in that book. I really could. So, you know, that's a fairly recent development that the extras are all people that I could just, you could give me one and I could start writing today about them.
Do you see that happening with any of the characters in this book that they will carry on?
Well, it could happen. You know, I won't name names yet because the contracts aren't signed, but we've sold it.
Oh.
To the films.
Really?
And if not films, episodic TV.
Oh,
and I'm pretty sure it's going to be a TV series. You know, limited series.
Yeah.
That being said, if and when that happens, if there's a second season, you're going to have to take those other characters, since the main characters, you know,
yes,
that's probably not going to be possible. So that's interesting to me. And yeah, I would be fascinated to see where some of the people in that story go. I can see it happening.
Mm-hmm. Love that. I love that. So I made a note on Sunday, and I don't know what exactly it means, but I wrote down, Luis was thinking of an Italian composer.
I was.
Well, what does that mean?
I was. Well, I not to sound pretentious, but I really was thinking about a piece of classical music. I've always loved Ottorino Respighi, the Italian composer, who was really fascinating to me. He was the first composer to use a tape recording as part of a symphony, and it was the tape recording of a mockingbird singing, which I thought was pretty awesome. But he had his two most famous pieces are The Pines of Rome and The Fountains of Rome. And I particularly love The Fountains of Rome. And so I've been recommending to everybody that they get it, partially because I love the thought of Chicano homies going to buy a symphony. Mm-hmm. That makes me excited, because it's exciting music. And during the writing of this, at a very difficult time, during the writing of it, the Chicago Symphony Orchestra did a Respighi night, and my wife took me. I'd never seen the music live or heard it live, and it confirmed everything that I was hoping to compose in the book, in that, you know, The Fountains of Rome specifically is a tone poem in a way based on each of the fountains of Rome. And you go to each neighborhood and the music represents all the tumult and sparkle and wildness, and it goes through neighborhoods, some of which are more somber than others. But if you listen to the piece and read the book, you can see that it has the same kind of structure, and it's got it's even got a coda. And I had been planning for the novel to have a coda, but I wanted it to have a coda that wasn't tacky, and that would also carry some of the theme again. It was a little bit of a Pulp Fiction move on my part, in that it's a book, a hilarious book about dying, which is weird in itself. But then the coda is a kind of a false way to bring back characters who've just passed away. And it was intended to suggest life going on, life after death, the life of the spirit. And in The Fountains of Rome, after all this journey has ended, there's a musical coda where the strings of the orchestra go down a really meditative series of chords down to silence. And in the background, there's just the tolling of a church bell. And the whole wild piece of music fades into this moment for you to think and to meditate and feel and maybe pray, who knows? And when we saw it live, it just slayed me, because I thought, it's awesome on record, no question, but to hear it live as the whole hall is resonating with that, that's exactly the feeling I was hoping for in the book. But, you know, it's one of those secret elements. I don't know if I've even talked about it in interviews, so you've got the exclusive.
That's great. I'm going to have to find that. I've never heard that music.
And, it's great. It's great. The Pines of Rome is more... It's like prog rock almost. It's like listening to old Yes albums. You know, it's sort of a portrait of Roman centurions marching into Rome through the pines. But yeah, The Fountains of Rome is quite lovely.
Hmm. And something else I wanted to talk about that I don't know if we've ever talked about on this show. Maybe in the 20 years we've been on the air. But that is epigraphs. I love epigraphs in novels, and I pay attention to them, and I feel like they are a doorway into the book.
Yeah.
And I wondered if you would read yours and then talk about why you chose those two.
All right. Oh, you're going to love this. All right. So the first epigraph is from Aztec poetry, as it should be. Every one of my books should have some Aztec Nahuatl poetry in it. But it's a famous bit, one of the lines, but... it's by a poet named Ayokwan. Must I go alone like flowers that die? Will nothing remain of my name? Nothing of my fame here on earth? At least my flowers. At least my songs. Mm. It's pretty self-explanatory. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the great poems about mortality. A little ironic, you know, from people who sacrifice tens of thousands of human beings, but still, it's something to think about. It's just a beautiful poem. And the line by Rick Elias, "This is my confession of love," is the absolute truth about why I wrote the book. But there's some stuff about that Rick Elias character that's interesting, since this is a radio show. Rick Elias was one of my dearest high school besties, you know, and we were a terrible duo doing stuff together, and he's a songwriter, and I used to write lyrics for him. And we had a theater group and all this stuff. We've been friends since 1971. He went on to record for a while. And he has an album called Rick Elias and the Confessions. And Confession of Love is one of my favorite rock songs that he wrote. And that's the line from it. And the other thing, inside joke for the book, we used to have a group of artistic morons that we did things with in San Diego, and we called ourselves the La Cruz Brothers. He was Bimbo La Cruz. I was Pepito La Cruz. And so the name in the family was partially to make Rick laugh, because I knew once he saw the book, he would know exactly where that name came from.
That's great. Oh, my goodness. Well, you know, we have a couple of minutes left. I think we should have booked a couple of hours because...
I'll come back.
Okay. Yes. Maybe when the paperback comes out,
you
could come back. But we do have a few minutes. And so I wanted to know what happened to the novel then that you were writing and almost through with when it took a turn.
I'm so glad you asked. It was a World War II novel. And... about women in the Red Cross, and it's completing my rounds of duty to my family. It was based on my mother's experience in the war, and I was, like I said, 400 some pages in, and these things happen, and I didn't know that this had to be a novel. I didn't know it was a book, but my wife and, of all people, Jim Harrison, told me it was, so I buckled down and wrote this one instead. But when you get, I think we talked about this a little in L.A., but, I try to write my way off the end of the branch. I try to leap into places I don't know how to write every time I write. And when I got done with this, I realized that I had been approaching that other book in an inauthentic way. And part of my problem with it was that I've spent so much of my energies honoring the Mexican side and just recently have been spending energies honoring my American side. And I realized that to tell my mother's story didn't mean I had to find some new voice. I could use the lyrical voice that I have. That's me. That's my voice. But I could tell her story that way just as well as I could tell the Spanish stories. You know what I mean? Mm. And so I've gone back, and I have all this astounding research. You know, last summer, for example, we went to Germany and traced her steps through Germany, to Bavaria and up to Buchenwald and then into Austria, things like that. And so I'm recuperating since I just returned from tour yesterday. It's so funny because I've been like, yeah, I'm home from tour. Well, wait, I have to do a radio interview and then I have to go to a photo shoot. But then I'm home after that.
Until the next thing.
I'm pretty booked for about a year, but it's time to go back to it, and do what I need to do on that book. I'm really excited about that book. So,
I'll love to read that.
You will.
Yeah.
I'll send it to you.
Okay.
All right.
So, you know, just one thing we haven't talked about at all, and you've been a professor for a while, and how do you teach writing?
Oh, my.
I mean, do you feel like your job is to help writers find their voice and tell the stories as they know how, or are you focused on mechanics and craft or a little bit of each?
No.
What are you doing?
No mechanics, no craft. There are mechanics and craft, and you want to help people, you know, make better sentences and better compositions and so forth. But, you know, it's been interesting being an academic, because I think I do better work when I'm at a writing workshop up on a mountain somewhere. And I tell my students this. I feel like I teach writing better if I'm somewhere where there are beavers. Beavers and deer. And that's kind of hard to do in downtown Chicago. And it took me a lot of years to realize that what happens in my room is what happens in my room with those students. And I don't have to try to mimic all the brilliant professors around me. I can just go ahead and imagine the beavers in the room, and off we go. So to me, the idea of being a writer is a, you know, it's a way of life. It's a path. Dare I say, a spiritual path. And, you know, when I realize that that's how I live, that's what I believe, and that's what I believe for them, it made the workshops a lot better. And, you know, my students, I tell them, just humor my eccentricity for 15 weeks and see what happens. That, you know, I'm not worried about your grade, and I'm not worried about your PhD. I'm worried about you getting your black belt. You're going to walk this life way, and you're going to get your black belt in writing. And it's fun. You know, we can go places that are so wonderful, and it's been bearing fruit, and I'm so excited, you know, to see students publishing books or publishing pieces or being accepted to Bread Loaf or things like that around the country. Mm-hmm. It makes me so happy. And I think it's made a very loving relationship between those young writers and me. And, you know, you want to go to a place you love. You want to do things you love. I do anyway. I'm spoiled.
Well, I am sad that we're at the end of our time, but I'm so happy we had this time.
Me too.
And can't wait to talk to you again. And thank you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for everything.
You're welcome. That was Luis Alberto Uria. His novel is The House of Broken Angels, published by Little Brown. That's all the time we have today. We'll be back next week. In the meantime, writers out there, stay in the chair and have a good week.